Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 118. It's Monday, June 14th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, going to start this week with a bold statement. I think is very true. The FDA has made a huge mistake. Last week, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new Alzheimer's drug with very sketchy efficacy data. The Scientific Advisory Committee decidedly recommended against approval, yet the FDA approved it anyways. The drug is hugely expensive and difficult to administer. And last but not least, the drug has common serious side effects. So let's go ahead and do a couple articles regarding this. First up from the Hill, FDA approves first new Alzheimer's drug in almost 20 years. The FDA last Monday granted approval for the first new Alzheimer's treatment since 2003. The decision comes as the debate over whether to approve Biogen's drug has stirred controversy, with some Alzheimer's experts and an independent advisory committee opposing approval, saying there's not enough evidence that the drug is effective. The FDA usually follows its advisory committee's recommendations, but this time it strayed from the Peripheral and Central Nervous Systems Drug Advisory Committee's recommendation in November to overwhelmingly reject Biogen's drug. With an accelerated approval, Biogen will be required to conduct another trial to prove the clinical benefit of its drug. The FDA could take steps to remove the drug from the market if benefit is not proven. The drug maker, along with Japanese pharmaceutical company Eisai, announced a price, saying the cost will amount to a yearly cost of about $56,000 per patient. The two partnering companies said they would not increase the price over the next 4 years. Well, how generous of them. But Michael Carome, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, condemned the FDA's decision, arguing the close collaboration between Biogen and the agency dangerously compromised the agency's review process. The FDA's decision shows a stunning disregard for science and eviscerates the agency's standard for approving new drugs, Carome said in a statement. Because of this reckless action, the agency's credibility has been irreparably damaged. And more on this story from Stat News. An extra twist in the FDA's Alzheimer's decision. No limits on which patients can get the drug. Many experts were left stunned by that decision. The broad approval from the FDA raises the stakes for some of the other players in the healthcare system and could force some tough decisions. Insurers might now set tight limits on how they'll cover the therapy, and clinicians could face even greater demand and pressure from families to prescribe the treatment. A lot of people, in the absence of something they know is better, will want to try it, said neurologist Victor Henderson of Stanford University, who has advised the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, a nonprofit that estimates the value of new medicines. Henderson said it could be hard for some physicians to really hold back the flow of requests. If you're a neurologist in private practice, there's probably more incentive to try to satisfy the family demands, the patient demands, he said. Doctors also receive an extra markup when prescribing an infused drug. That means to receive Aduhelm, the new drug, and to get it covered, many patients will likely need to pass through a series of steps. First, getting a diagnosis from a neurologist or geriatrician of mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia tied to Alzheimer's. Then, confirming that they have amyloid plaques, either through a type of imaging called a PET scan or through a test of the cerebrospinal fluid. And finally, getting a spot at an infusion center where they will be treated once a month. Experts have warned for years that the health system, with a shortage of specialists, equipment, and clinics at every step of that odyssey, is not prepared for a therapy like this drug. People could face long delays before they can get treated, all the more pressing given the degenerative nature of the disease. We're hugely under-resourced as a country in terms of availability of PET scanners. We're hugely under-resourced in terms of the specialists who would be required to make a diagnosis. And we're hugely under-resourced in terms of the specialists who can run the amyloid tests on cerebral spinal fluid, which is typically sampled via a lumbar puncture. Neurologist Alan Levy of Emory University told Stat last week ahead of the FDA decision. On top of that, Levy said, there is a limited capacity at the infusion centers that will deliver the therapy to patients. Medicare and other patients have generally not covered PET scans for confirming the presence of amyloid, and coverage for the cerebrospinal fluid testing is mixed, experts say. With the FDA approval of this drug, however, it's thought that insurers could start paying for the procedures. Identifying the patients who would most likely benefit from this drug could also require a fundamental shift in dementia care. Many people with dementia never receive a firm diagnosis, or wait years after experiencing the first hints of cognitive loss before seeking out a specialist. Advocacy groups have been pushing for earlier intervention for years, but because there have been so few therapeutic options, there hasn't been an urgency. Now, though, patients have a tangible motivation to get a diagnosis when their conditions are still in the early stages. One concern is that if insurers clamp down on who can receive the therapy, wealthy people will just pay for it on their own, even if they are unlikely to benefit from it. They could add a greater crunch at clinics like infusion centers and potentially exacerbate access disparities in dementia care. There are going to be a lot of people who are driving up in their limousines who want treatment and will pay for it themselves, Levy says. It's not just anxieties around healthcare costs that mean many clinicians will likely only recommend a therapy for particular patients, doctors stressed. Some neurologists, meanwhile, preemptively announce they won't prescribe the treatment at all because they don't believe it works. Rather, if clearing away amyloid plaques really does slow the progression of the disease, as goes the argument supporting the drug's effectiveness, that will only make a difference before the progression has advanced to a certain point. For people with severe and even moderate disease, doctors say, it's not worth the potential side effects of the therapy and the trouble of monthly infusions to get the drug. This medication would not help anyone who has more than just mild changes, said Douglas Shari, a neurologist and director of cognitive neurology at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center, who was also an investigator in the drug trials and has advised Biogen. Everyone with Alzheimer's disease should not be on this drug. And lastly, but not leastly, also from Stat News, excerpted from FAQs, what you need to know about the Alzheimer drug Aduhelm. Any side effects? In two clinical trials, about 40% of clinical trial patients who got the approved dose of Aduhelm developed painful brain swelling. Symptoms included headache, dizziness, visual disturbances, nausea, and vomiting. About 17 to 18% of patients had microhemorrhages or small bleeds in their brain. Patients will be monitored for brain swelling before their 7th and 12th infusions. If imaging shows severe swelling, treatment can continue, quote, with caution only after a clinical evaluation and a follow-up MRI demonstrates radiographic stabilization, the label says. What I say? Yikes! I literally cannot imagine a situation where I or someone I love would want to take this drug. Holy moly. And of course, the infusion of such an expensive drug into our healthcare system drives up prices. This from USA Today. Prescription drug prices increased twice the inflation rate of U.S. economy in 2020, the AARP report finds. Brand name prescription drugs widely used by seniors saw their slowest average annual price increase in 2020 since 2006. But the 2.9% increase is still twice the Mercury's general inflation rate of 1.3%, according to a report from the AARP. The findings, published by the AARP's Public Policy Institute RX Price Watch report, showed insurance negotiated prices of 260 brand name prescription drugs have increased, on average, faster than general inflation every year since 2006. If current trends continue, consumers can expect increasing out-of-pocket costs, including higher deductibles, premiums, and cost-sharing. Drug price increases also strain taxpayer-funded programs like Medicare, according to the report. Wow, so the good news is it's the slowest average annual price increase since 2006. The bad news is it's still over twice as much as the country's general inflation rate. Yikes again.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, we're still in the middle of a global pandemic, and as the new vaccination rate slows in the U.S., we have this from the Hill. 78% of unvaccinated Americans unlikely to change their mind, says Gallup poll. More than 3 in 4 Americans who have yet to receive a coronavirus vaccine say it is unlikely they ever will, according to a new poll. Among U.S. adults who do not plan to be vaccinated, 78% said in a Gallup poll released last Monday they are unlikely to reconsider their plans. Roughly half, 51%, indicated they are not likely at all to change their mind and get vaccinated. Overall, just 1 in 5 vaccine-reluctant adults said they are open to reconsidering, with 2% saying they are very likely and 19% saying they are somewhat likely to ever get inoculated. Okay, well, what the future holds regarding COVID-19 for the world depends a lot on variants, so let's do a couple stories on that. This from Medical Express. UK says Delta variant 60% more transmissible. The British government said Friday that the new Delta coronavirus variant is 60% more transmissible in households than the variant that forced the UK to lock down in January. The Delta variant, which first emerged in India, has caused a rise in cases in Britain, prompting questions about whether social distancing restrictions will be lifted as planned from June 21st. More than 90% of new cases were of the Delta variant, the government said. And back in the States, from the Hill, CDC estimates Alpha variant made up 66% of COVID-19 cases in April. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated in a study released last Thursday that the Alpha variant made up about 66% of COVID-19 infections in the U.S. in mid-April. The research also measured the prevalence of the Gamma variant, also known as P1, which made up an estimated 5% of cases in the U.S. between April 11th and 24th. This represents a rise from when the CDC predicted the strain first discovered in Brazil made up 0.01% of cases in the two-week period ending with January 30th. The agency projects that in the two-week period April 25th to May 8th, the Alpha variant made up 72.4% of cases, and the Gamma strain made up 6.2% of cases. Experts have warned that variants of COVID-19 present the potential to be more transmissible, cause more serious illness, and potentially evade therapeutics and vaccines. HHS Region 5, with Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin, saw the highest proportion of Gamma strain cases in that time period. But last month, the New York Times reported that the agency moved to only track breakthrough cases, cases that occur in a fully vaccinated person, if that person is hospitalized or dies. The decision sparked criticism from experts who were concerned the limited tracking could allow an undetected variant capable of thwarting the vaccine to spread quicker, although the CDC argued it was focusing on the most important cases. So this seems like a really big reversal. When Biden came into office, they put a couple billion dollars into genomic sequencing to track the variants. Now it seems that they've extremely limited the amount that they're actually testing. This is going to limit our ability to do surveillance of these new variants, which of course are on the rise, and the most dangerous ones, because they're more transmissible, are likely to become the dominant. So let's look at this longer article to get into the details of that with Stat News. More transmissible, wilier variant makes COVID-19 vaccinations even more crucial, experts say. It is getting even riskier to remain unvaccinated. The United States as a whole is still in good shape for the summer reunions and revived activities, but for those who haven't been immunized against COVID-19, there is a new concern: the emergence of yet another coronavirus variant, one with a nasty combination of features that makes it even more dangerous than the other strains that have caused global alarms. The variant, known as Delta, was first spotted in India and helped power that country's recent explosive outbreaks. Also called B1617.2, it seems to be the most transmissible version of the coronavirus seen thus far, but also carries some ability to get around the body's immune protection generated after vaccines or an initial infection. There's also some evidence that is more likely to cause severe disease, though researchers are still trying to confirm that. It's really like the worst of both worlds, said epidemiologist Nathan Grubaugh of the Yale School of Public Health. Globally, the variants march around the world could ignite major epidemics, given vaccine shortages in many nations. In unvaccinated populations, experts generally have greater fears about more transmissible variants than ones that are, say, just deadlier because of causing more cases than would have occurred otherwise. The faster spreading strains can result in greater hospitalizations and deaths overall. Delta appears to be able to do that and more. Taken all together, this is something which is really, really anxiety-inducing from a global health perspective, said epidemiologist William Hanaj of Harvard School of Public Health. In the United States, Delta accounts for just 6% of sequenced cases, federal health officials said this last week, though its prevalence is building. On an individual level, people who have had their full vaccine regimens, a figure that this week in the U.S. crossed 50% among those aged 12 and older, don't need to be particularly worried about Delta. The COVID-19 immunizations retain the large bulk of their effectiveness against the variant. Though with different vaccines used in different parts of the world, scientists are still parsing how each of them fare. Experts so far have been particularly impressed about how strongly the two-dose mRNA vaccines, which account for the bulk of shots delivered in the U.S., stand up to different versions of the virus. But it's not as if the SARS-CoV-2 virus has disappeared from the United States. It's been clear that it would continue to circulate among unvaccinated people going forward. Now, any cluster that emerge and are driven by Delta will grow bigger and faster. And for those who do contract it, with some evidence from England indicating that people infected with Delta are more likely to be hospitalized, it's going to be worse for them, Hanaj said. With so many people vaccinated, whatever outbreaks occur likely won't lead to huge spikes that inundate hospitals, but they will lead to some people dying. Nationwide, cases have plunged from where they were just months ago, though the pace of decline has slowed. Study after study has shown the vaccines aren't just protecting people from COVID-19, but are blunting transmission. That wall of protection will benefit people who are unvaccinated as well other factors that could be contributing to lower transmission rates, including immunity levels from natural infection and seasonal factors that seem to put some brake on speed. But some unvaccinated people remain more vulnerable than others. The story of the pandemic, both globally and within the United States, has been one of hotspots in areas that are better protected. Now, states where immunization rates are lagging, like Idaho, Wyoming, Louisiana, Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi, are going to be more susceptible to ongoing outbreaks than states like those in the Northeast, where vaccine uptake has been much higher, particularly as communities slough off remaining countermeasures. Plus, more transmissible variants like Delta require a higher level of population immunity to be slowed. And this tweet from President Biden. Folks, the Delta variant, a highly infectious COVID-19 strain, is spreading rapidly among young people between age 12 and 20 years old in the UK. If you're young and haven't got your shot yet, it really is time. It's the best way to protect yourself and those you love. The silver lining of the appearance of different variants is that for whatever twists evolution has thrown our way, the vaccines have largely been able to withstand them. Variants that have some capability to escape the immune response elicited by vaccines might cause breakthrough infections at higher rates, and their transmission might not be slowed as quickly. The shots, however, have maintained their incredibly robust ability to prevent sickness and severe outcomes from COVID-19. But research into Delta has also underscored the importance of getting both shots of the two-dose vaccines. A study from Public Health England last month showed the Pfizer regimen was 88% effective at protecting against symptomatic illness from the variant, and the AstraZeneca vaccine was 60% effective, just slight drops in performance compared to other forms of the virus. But after just one shot, those figures plummeted to 33% for both vaccines. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not been authorized in the United States. After the second dose, we see the amount of antibody in a person's blood is even higher than after the first dose, and therefore more people will be above a threshold. Wendy Barclay, a virologist at Imperial College London, said at a press briefing, "There's a certain level of antibody and immunity you need to be protected. We know that there's a certain level for the alpha variant, and there will be a slightly higher level required to protect against delta variant." The alpha variant Barclay referenced is also known as B.1.1.7 and first appeared last fall in the United Kingdom. Before Delta, it was the most transmissible variant and became dominant in a number of countries, including the United States, but does not have any meaningful immune escape prowess. Scientists have estimated that Delta is perhaps 60% more transmissible than Alpha, and in the UK, it's overtaken Alpha in frequency, which some experts have speculated could happen in the United States as well. The latest U.S. data indicated Alpha accounted for nearly 70% of sequenced cases, but Delta is amassing. The urgency, then, is to get as many people immunized as quickly as possible, so more people are protected and there are fewer infections overall, as Delta increasingly accounts for more of the country's cases. If you've had your first dose, make sure to get your second dose. And for those who have not been vaccinated yet, please get vaccinated. Tony Fauci, the director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, said at a White House briefing where he highlighted the threat of Delta. There are several factors that appear to give Delta its transmission boost over Alpha. For one, Delta can transmit more easily in an unvaccinated population than the Alpha variant can, epidemiologist Neil Ferguson of Imperial College London told reporters. That advantage will become particularly noticeable in countries with a higher vaccination coverage, like the United Kingdom and the United States, because Alpha will encounter greater barriers as it tries to spread. It's not that Delta can run rampant through vaccinated populations. It's a matter that it can transmit comparatively more efficiently because of its immune escape capability. In fact, some experts anticipate that in the United States, variants like Delta, Beta, and Gamma could start to claw away at Alpha's dominance because they have greater abilities to spread among vaccinated populations, though the likelihood of that will depend on how many people remain unvaccinated. But Delta also appears to have some other advantages. The virus itself is fitter for human airway cells, Barclay said, about what early research indicates. That means that an infected person will likely emit more virus into the air, and that the virus is more adept at infecting cells, so people need to be exposed to less of it to contract it. And lastly, on the variants, this from The Hill. Delta variant's UK dominance sparks concerns in US. The Delta variant's quick dominance over other COVID-19 strains in the United Kingdom is sparking concerns that the US could be hit with a similar wave of new cases in the coming months. Public health experts are projecting that the highly transmissible variant will soon overtake the Alpha strain in the U.S. and later become the dominant form of the coronavirus. Eric Feigl-Deng, an epidemiologist and senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, said he expects a surge in Delta cases in the U.S. late next month or in August. If the U.K. is where we should draw our lessons, I think the U.S. is in for a surge in the lower vaccinated states, he said. The rise in UK cases, he added, is a sign that its vaccination rate currently is not enough to slow it down. In the UK, 78% of adults have received at least one vaccine dose, and 55.4% are fully vaccinated. Among US adults, 64% have received at least one dose, and 53.4% are fully vaccinated. What it means is the US is not invulnerable from the invasion of the Delta variant and from surges from the Delta variant, Feigl-Deng said, noting that he hopes U.S. vaccines keep the total cases, quote, under control. Again, as a reminder, people, one of the big things with this Delta and then the P1, the so-called Brazilian variant, is that they cut through previous natural infection. And of course, people that were infected longer ago, say early in the pandemic, actually could have waning immunity as well. So if you have been infected previously, you still could benefit greatly from a dose of the COVID-19 vaccines. Okay, well, next up in what some may call in the perhaps too little too late department, this from Kaiser Health News. Labor Department issues emergency rules to protect healthcare workers from COVID. Labor Department officials last Thursday announced a temporary emergency standard to protect health workers, saying they face grave danger in the workplace from the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The new standard would require employers to remove workers who have COVID-19 from the workplace, notify workers of COVID exposure at work, and strengthen requirements for employers to report worker deaths or hospitalizations to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. The new rules are set to take effect immediately after publication in the Federal Register and are expected to affect about 10.3 million healthcare workers nationwide. The Lost on the Frontline project documented early calls for better respiratory protection for healthcare workers than loose-fitting face masks, noted serious complaints to OSHA from hospital workers that went unaddressed and revealed repeated employer failures to report dozens of worker deaths. It also found that healthcare employers were often remiss in notifying workers about exposure to coronavirus on the job. The new standard would address some of those problems. There's a lot to like about the new rule, except for the timing, according to Barbara Rosen, Vice President of the Health Professionals and Allied Employees Union, New Jersey. It's a little late, she said. If we had had this in place in the beginning, it would have saved a lot of lives and a lot of suffering that has gone on with healthcare workers and probably patients in hospitals because of the spread. She said she was pleased with the requirement that workers be paid when they isolate with COVID and that employers formulate a detailed COVID plan with input of non-managers. The day after he took office, President Joe Biden issued an executive order calling on OSHA to, quote, take swift action to reduce the risk that workers may contract COVID-19 in the workplace. The rule has been criticized for coming late, about which Labor Department officials said in a press call that such standards typically take years, not months, to formulate. It has also been derided for failing to enact requirements on employers outside of healthcare. OSHA's failure to issue a COVID-specific standard on other high-risk industries like meat and poultry processing, corrections, homeless shelters, and retail establishments is disappointing, according to a statement from David Michaels, a former OSHA administrator and professor with the George Washington University School of Public Health. If exposure is not controlled in these workplaces, they will continue to be important drivers of infections. The new rule also cites 67,000 worker complaints during the pandemic, with more complaints about healthcare settings than any other industry. The rule would protect workers from retaliation for staying home when sick with COVID, alerting their employer about a COVID hazard, or exercising their rights under the emergency rule. The new rules exempt some office-based healthcare workplaces where all staff members are vaccinated and measures are taken to screen people with potential illness. The rule summary estimates the measure will prevent 776 deaths and 295,000 infections. So better late than never. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update. Well, cases have been going down, but it looks like we've seen a leveling off and even maybe a little bit of an uptick nationally. And it looks like we may be seeing the same thing locally here. The Lucas County average daily number of COVID-19 cases crept up to 16 a day from 13 a day the previous week. Our rates of trying to get it under the 50, the original metric that Governor DeWine had for opening things back up, we're at 68. Ohio is at 44. Congratulations, Ohio. You've met that metric. That's the first week that has been met. We seem to actually open up the everything pretty much a little bit before that, but so much for metrics. We take them or leave them, I guess, huh? Move the goalposts. Okay, well, in other good news, the testing positivity rate, the percent of people who test positive who seek testing, it dropped to 2% from 2.2% the previous week in Lucas County. And it dropped even further and faster in the state of Ohio as a whole, down to 1.6% from 2.1% the previous week. Congratulations, Ohio and Lucas County. Okay, nursing homes. We had a little bit of uptick in average cases, up to 9, 3 residents and 6 staff from 6 total the previous week. We haven't been able to crush down below where we were a few months ago when we hit 5, 4, and 8 cases 3 weeks in a row. So hopefully we'll get there, but still it is hanging on. New hospitalizations that have been declining steadily over the last couple months has actually leveled off in the last week in both Lucas County and Ohio, which sort of begs the question, are we at some kind of inflection point or some kind of leveling off where we're going to stick at a level for a long time? We'll have to wait and see. And that's one of the reasons why I reported on all those variants, because that seems to be getting worse, meaning that if all else stays the same, in other words, if we don't get a lot more people vaccinated, these new variants are going to be able to transmit more easily, particularly among the unvaccinated population, and we could see increases again. Okay, well, this is the fact that this is COVID is still killing people in Lucas County. Our death rate, we've had 19 deaths over the last 14 days, and that's actually an increase. This has been persistently high, multiples time higher than the state and national death rates. The good news nationally is that we've fallen to a daily average of under 400 per day, compared to 3 or even 4,000 a day at the peak of the epidemic at the beginning of this year. Okay, well, vaccines in the U.S. this last week was the first time since we've ramped up testing, vaccinating, that we've had less than a 1% increase in the percent of the population who received at least one dose. And Ohio and Lucas County had even less than that. The bottom line for Ohio and Lucas County is that while the nation is slowing down, state and locally, we are falling further behind the national average. So we're seeing this gap between different areas in the country. Unfortunately, Ohio is below average, and Lucas County is even below the Ohio average. That does it for our local COVID-19 report. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's spend the last half of the show talking about non-COVID-19 public health news. Here's an interesting article from Medical Express. Study suggests unmedicated, untreated brain illness is likely in mass shooters. The first analysis of medical evidence on domestic mass shooters in the U.S. finds that a large majority of perpetrators have psychiatric disorders for which they have received no medication or other treatment, reports a study in the Journal of Clinical Psychopharmacology. Without losing sight of the larger perspective that most who are violent are not mentally ill, and most of the mentally ill are not violent, our message is that mental health providers, lawyers, and the public should be made aware that some unmedicated patients do pose an increased risk of violence, according to the report by Ira Glick, MD of Stanford University School of Medicine, and colleagues. The researchers identified 115 persons identified as committing a mass shooting in the United States from 1982 to 2019, based on the most comprehensive listing available, which was the Mother Jones database. The database excluded shootings related to, quote, conventionally motivated crimes, such as armed robbery or gang violence. In the vast majority of the incidents identified in the database, the perpetrator died either during or shortly after the crime, the researchers note. I just want to editorialize a little bit and just emphasize this: the vast majority of the incidents identified in the database, the perpetrator died either during or shortly after the crime. Now, this makes it harder to evaluate a person when they're already dead, of course, for this study, but it's a really important thing because a lot of these murders, these mass murders, these mass shootings are actually suicides as well. Often cases, the shooter takes their own life. Of course, in some of the cases, the police take the life of the shooter in a shootout. Okay, they focus on the 35 cases where the assailant survived and underwent criminal proceedings. providing the best information on their symptoms of mental illness and psychiatric state. Based on the data, 32 of the 35 perpetrators had signs and symptoms of brain illness, which fit scientific diagnostic criteria for a clinical psychiatric disorder. 18 of the shooters had schizophrenia, while 10 had other diagnoses, including bipolar disorder, delusional disorder, personality disorders, and substance-related disorders. Of the 28 surviving assailants with a psychiatric diagnosis, none were medicated or received other treatment prior to the crime, the researchers write. They also analyzed 20 mass shooters who died at the crime scene, using available data from the media or significant others. 8 assailants had schizophrenia, 7 had other diagnoses, 5 had unknown diagnoses. Similarly, none were receiving appropriate medications. Okay, well, this adds some insight into the proverbial and perennial question when shootings happen, why? And of course, accents each and every call to improvement in our mental health system in this country. Okay, and another gun-related story, this from Medical Express. Alarming rising trends in suicide by firearms in young Americans. Deaths from suicide are rising in the United States. These rising trends are especially alarming because global trends in suicide are on a downward trajectory. Moreover, in the U.S., the major mode of suicide among young Americans is by firearms. Researchers from Florida Atlantic University's College of Medicine and collaborators explored trends in suicide by firearms in young white and black Americans, age 5 to 24 years, from 1999 to 2018. Results published in the journal Annals of Public Health and Research showed that between 2008 and 2018, rates of suicide by firearms quadrupled in young Americans aged 5 to 14 years and increased by 50% among those aged 15 to 24 years. Deaths from suicide by firearms were more prevalent in white than black Americans. These trends are in marked contrast with homicide by firearms, which are far more prevalent in black than white Americans. While further analytic studies are needed, there are certainly important public health implications in this data, said Dr. Sarah Wood, senior author, interim dean, and senior associate dean for education. From 1996 to 2020, U.S. federal laws effectively prohibited research related to investigations of death from firearms. However, in 2020, $25 million was appropriated to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. National Institutes of Health to conduct analytic studies. This is just a reminder, I guess, that we're now first starting to see the results of these analyses and studies that were banned for almost a quarter of a century. This, I think, is one of the best examples of public health malpractice by our Congress, Republican Congress specifically, that banned the study of firearm deaths in the U.S. back in 1996, and we were only able to reverse that in 2020. So hopefully we'll get more information and understand the problem better so we can more effectively develop solutions. Okay, well, let's switch our focus to smoking, the single largest preventable cause of death in this country. This from Medical Express. Many adults with cardiovascular disease know the risk, yet still don't stop smoking. Many adults with a history of cardiovascular disease continue to smoke cigarettes and/or use other tobacco products, despite knowing it increases their risk of having another cardiovascular event, according to new research published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. In the final survey, 4 or 5 years later, fewer than a quarter of smokers with cardiovascular disease had quit using tobacco. Participation in a formal smoking cessation program dwindled from 10% of respondents during the second wave of the survey to approximately 2% by the end of the study. Among other notable findings, most of the study participants with cardiovascular disease, 96%, reported knowing or believing that smoking can cause heart disease in smokers. A significant proportion of the study participants, 40%, said they believed e-cigarettes were less harmful than combustible cigarettes. The prevalence of e-cigarette use and dual use, smoking both combustible cigarettes and e-cigarettes, was higher among those participants who said they believed e-cigarettes were less harmful than cigarettes, compared to those who believed e-cigarettes are more harmful than cigarettes. Dual use of cigarettes and e-cigarettes was more common among study participants than use of e-cigarettes alone. Trends for tobacco use varied by gender, age, race, ethnicity, and other socioeconomic characteristics of study participants. Among adults with cardiovascular disease, use of any tobacco product was associated with younger age. Men were more likely than women to use any tobacco product except for e-cigarettes. Women were 70% more likely than men to use e-cigarettes. Hispanic participants were 60% less likely than white participants and 50% less likely than black participants to use any tobacco product. Low levels of household income were associated with a higher likelihood of using any tobacco product. Okay, folks. Well, for those of you that are smokers out there or have a loved one who smoke, here's a resource for you that I try to accent every once in a while. The 1-800-QUIT-NOW helpline, where you can get professional help through the phone and referrals to more help. That is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, next up, well, we all know that last year was a funky year with COVID-19, and that is definitely true with trying to keep tracks of different death rates. So this from The Hill. U.S. death rates from heart disease, diabetes see largest increases in more than 20 years. U.S. death rates in 2020 for heart disease and diabetes tracked their highest increases in more than 20 years amid the coronavirus pandemic. The Associated Press reported that the rate of heart disease deaths, which has been on the long-time decline, jumped by more than 3%, according to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In raw numbers, that spike is equivalent to 32,000 more heart disease deaths in 2020 than in 2019. The death rate for diabetes tracked a 14% increase. That increase is equal to 13,000 more diabetes deaths last year than in the previous year. Death rates jumped by 8% for Alzheimer's, 11% for Parkinson's, 12% for high blood pressure, and 4% for strokes. Experts are now saying that the spike in death rates for non-coronavirus diseases may be attributable to people not wanting to visit hospitals despite experiencing dangerous symptoms amid the pandemic out of fear of contracting the virus, the wire service reported. Another potential theory for the spike in death rates for these diseases is because some patients may have stopped taking care of themselves during the COVID-19 lockdowns, including exercising less, gaining weight, or cutting back on high blood pressure medications. The new statistics also bolster the belief among many that the true number of lives lost amid the pandemic, whether directly or indirectly attributed to COVID-19, is far higher than on record, the Associated Press added. The death rate for cancer, however, decreased last year. It dropped by approximately 2% in 2020, similar to the declines tracked from 2018 to 2019. Despite the fact that cancer screenings and cancer care lacked last year because of the pandemic. Well, this is all interesting, although I think they missed perhaps the biggest thing is that there is several lines of research that seem to document well that we have undercounted the amount of COVID-19 deaths, meaning that you had a death that was caused by COVID-19 but may have been reported something other than COVID-19, so it has to be reported as something. And of course, heart disease and diabetes are in the top leading causes of death, so you might see those actual COVID-19 deaths being reported as heart disease or diabetes, and that's true for all these other ones. So it's kind of a mess. It's probably going to take a year or two before we can start really sorting out these numbers more accurately, what the actual causes of death are and how much related to the pandemic and how much of it's not. But certainly the pandemic brought a lot more than just a virus. It brought stress and lockdowns, etc. Okay, well, this episode, we have a whole hodgepodge of different stories. This one next up from Public Health Newswire. Many U.S. physicians lack understanding, confidence about patients with disabilities. 26% of the U.S. population has some type of disability that is impairing, yet many of the nation's doctors say they do not feel confident about providing quality care to people with disabilities, a recent study finds. Published in Health Affairs, the study found a general lack of understanding among doctors about how people with disabilities live. Even though half of people with disabilities say they have good or excellent quality of life, many doctors perceive them as having limited happiness or lives. Lisa Iazzoni, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and lead author of the study, said many physicians do not understand the full lives of people with disabilities, which can have implications for their health care. For example, they don't think people with disability are sexually active, and so they don't talk to them about contraception, even though women may be at risk of unintended pregnancy, Iazzoni told the nation's health. Only about 41% of physicians said they were very confident about their ability to provide the same quality of care to patients with disabilities that they do to those without them. About 57% strongly agreed that they welcome people with disabilities into their practices. Researchers from Harvard University Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, who surveyed more than 700 doctors from a range of fields in 2019 to 2020, also found that more than 80% did not strongly agree that the healthcare system often treats people with disabilities unfairly. Yeah, there's a blindness, its own form of disability. People who have disabilities are at higher risk than the general population for a range of health issues, underscoring their need for adequate healthcare services. About 12% of people with disabilities have heart disease, compared to about 4% of those without disabilities. People with disabilities are also more likely to have obesity, diabetes, or smoke tobacco. They also face significant barriers to care. According to the CDC, a third of adults with disabilities under age 65 lack a usual healthcare provider, and a quarter have not had a routine checkup in the past year. With disabilities more common in older adults and the U.S. senior population expected to double by 2050, all physicians and healthcare providers can expect to see increasing volumes of patients with disability. All levels of medical education should include more training about disability, including disability cultural competence and etiquette. Training that provides greater empathy about patients' daily lives, such as house calls or standardized patients who have disability, might offer important insights. Okay, next up, for another population that's often overlooked by the healthcare system, this from Medical Express: Beyond Remission, From Alcohol Dependence to Optimal Mental Health. New research published online in this journal, Substance Use and Misuse, is good news for those struggling with alcohol dependence. The possibility of ending this dependency gets easier with age. Moreover, more than half of individuals who have been dependent on alcohol are free of any addictions or mental illness, and nearly 40% are in excellent mental health. Using data drawn from Statistics Canada's Canadian Community Health Survey Mental Health, researchers examined a nationally representative sample of 820 adult Canadians with a history of alcohol dependence to 19,945 who have never been addicted to alcohol. They found that in the past year, 71% of those with a history of alcohol dependence were no longer dependent, 52% were free from any addictions or mental illness, and 38% were in optimal mental health with high levels of happiness and social and psychological well-being. Past researchers largely focused on remission from alcohol dependence. We sought to understand the whole continuum of recovery. We wanted to know what factors were associated with flourishing, not merely remission, says first author Melissa Redman, assistant professor of social work at Carleton University. The high levels of resilience that we found are encouraging for those who are alcohol dependent, their family and loved ones, and for professionals in the field. Alcohol dependence is one of the leading causes of preventable deaths in the United States. Approximately 88,000 Americans die from alcohol-related causes every year, with nearly a third of all driving fatalities linked to alcohol-impaired driving. In the U.S., excessive alcohol use has been linked to close to $250 billion in economic losses annually. Considering the personal, communal, and economic consequences of alcohol dependence, there needs to be a greater understanding of factors associated with both remission and recovery, and corresponding improvements in mental health, relationships, and quality of life. Redman and her colleagues found social support to be strongly associated with remission from alcohol dependence and achieving optimal mental health. Additionally, among those with a history of alcohol dependence, each decade of age was associated with more than a 30% higher odds of remission from alcohol dependency and optimal mental health. With greater age, individuals often experience lower impulsivity, more family and work responsibilities, and a concomitant increased understanding of the negative impact that alcohol dependence has on quality of life, employment, family life, and social relationships, says co-author Esme Fuller-Thompson, professor at the University of Toronto's School of Social Work. Older individuals may have moved away from the social circles and alcohol-dependent social situations of their youth, which would make decreasing alcohol use easier. Okay, next up, I want to highlight a health policy briefing from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. This one is the connections between criminal justice and health. I'm just going to cover a couple highlights of this, and if you're more interested in this, you can go online, and I have a link to the full report, and that's the same link that I'll give at the end of the show with the bonus reads. Okay, here we go. Connections between criminal justice and health. There is a two-way relationship between criminal justice and health. Mental health and addiction challenges can lead to arrest and incarceration, and incarceration contributes to poor behavioral and physical health for many Ohioans. Racism and community conditions contribute to criminal justice involvement and poor health. Racist and discriminatory policies and practices and community conditions such as poverty, housing instability, and exposure to trauma lead to increased criminal justice involvement and drive poor health outcomes. Improvement is possible. There are evidence-informed policy solutions to combat the drivers of criminal justice involvement and poor health outcomes. And a couple examples under the category of taking action, with the policy goal of support mental well-being and improve crisis response for people at higher risk of criminal justice involvement. An example solution would be increase the number and effectiveness of crisis intervention teams, establish programs that dispatch medical professionals to behavioral health crises, and require crisis de-escalation training for all first responders. And another example of a policy goal, improve health for people who are currently or formerly incarcerated. An example policy option would be expand the use of telehealth in jail and prisons, including medical management of behavioral health conditions and consistent and accurate dispensing of medications. Okay, next up I have a piece written by Richard Besser, the head of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This from The Hill. Congress must close the Medicaid coverage gap once and for all. If a state ever deprived its residents of necessities like food or water, we would demand the federal government's urgent intervention. If the malnutrition and suffering that followed disproportionately hurt certain populations, we would call this an issue of justice and equity. For the past 7 years, not one state but a dozen have refused to expand Medicaid coverage to people under the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, denying millions access to affordable health care coverage. In most countries, access to health care, like access to food and water, is properly regarded as a fundamental human right. Yet neither generous federal financial incentives, evidence of the health benefits of Medicaid expansion, nor the worst pandemic in a century have persuaded these states to change course. Waiting for them to act is no longer a viable option. It is time for a robust federal response to expand Medicaid in these 12 states. The ACA faced partisan opposition from the outset. An early challenge led to the Supreme Court's ruling that states no longer required to expand their Medicaid programs. In the wake of that ruling, political considerations in some states won out over the health and well-being of their residents. Today, we can clearly see that states that have not expanded their Medicaid programs are neglecting some of their most vulnerable populations. An overwhelming body of evidence shows that state expansions of Medicaid have provided health insurance for millions, improved health outcomes for beneficiaries, and boosted state economies. Just as a person's zip code could dramatically influence one's opportunities and even life expectancy, the state in which a person lives today can determine whether they have access to basic medical care. As we have seen repeatedly through the COVID-19 pandemic, access to care can determine whether a person lives or dies. Opponents in states that have not expanded Medicaid often cite costs as this reason. This argument has little merit. Consider the suite of financial incentives that a state would receive if expanded Medicaid today. Under the ACA, the federal government would cover 90% of the cost of expansion for newly covered adults. Under the American Rescue Plan Act, that state would receive an additional 5 percentage points increase in the federal matching rate for 2 years. In other words, the federal government would bear the vast majority of the expansion costs, while that state would reap the health and economic benefits. Even so, states have not budged. Once again, we have a situation in which the color of one's skin determines one's opportunity for health. Black and brown people are affected disproportionately by the Medicaid coverage gap. More than 60% of the 2.2 million adults who would be covered if the 12 holdout states expanded Medicaid are people of color, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Their new report released sheds additional light on this uninsured population. The racial and ethnic disparities are stark. Blacks are 14% of the U.S. population, but 28% of the population impacted by the coverage gap, while Hispanics are 18% and 28% respectively. Among the adults in the coverage gap, 15% have a disability, while 1 in 3 are parents with children at home. The report also notes that most adults in the coverage gap are employed, but in jobs that are disproportionately less likely to offer health insurance, making Medicaid access even more essential. The COVID reinforces that populations disproportionately affected by COVID-19 are the same populations most likely to be uninsured. These are not coincidences, but patterns that reflect our nation's past and present. Congress can take several paths to end this coverage gap, from a federalized Medicaid program to full subsidy coverage under the ACA's health insurance exchanges, A debate over the specifics of these and other proposals is warranted. We should strive for the quickest and most cost-effective program that covers the most people. But we must start with the principle that access to high-quality, affordable health care is a fundamental right. Accordingly, it is not a question of whether Congress should act, but when. If Congress stands down, it will be reinforcing an uncomfortable and lamentable truth about this country. Healthcare is a luxury, available to some, but not all. Congress must not allow this moment of opportunity to pass. I come to this not just as the head of the nation's largest health philanthropy, but as a practicing general pediatrician. I have treated uninsured children and their families and have seen the toll. Many live in fear that they won't be able to receive the care they need if they get sick, that their children won't grow up healthy, that a sudden serious illness could bankrupt them. No one should have to live with that fear. I know, too, that simply closing the Medicaid coverage gap will not solve our coverage problem, and that more will need to be done to increase access and affordability. These additional steps should include making marketplace plans more affordable, lowering prescription drug costs, and reforming Medicare Part D benefits. We must also reform Medicaid itself to ensure more uniformity in what state plans cover and at what rates the program reimburses providers. The most generous Medicaid benefits should not be reserved for people in certain states. Ultimately, we must find a way to guarantee the right of every person in the United States to access quality care, no matter their skin color, income level, or zip code. Despite the considerable coverage gains over the past decade under the Affordable Care Act, about 30 million people in the United States still lacked health insurance when the pandemic began, and the number of uninsured will remain too high even if Congress is successful in this effort. But in our drive towards universal health insurance, there's no better place to start than with closing the Medicaid coverage gap, and there's no more critical time to get the job done than right now.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, the last story I want to cover is some good news from the global public health scene. This from Medical Express. $5.1 billion effort to eradicate polio announced. A $5.1 billion plan to eradicate polio worldwide by 2026 was announced last week by the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, a public-private partnership led by national governments and health groups. For decades, the initiative has been trying to rid the world of polio by immunizing every child against the polio virus, but the COVID-19 pandemic interrupted that effort, leading to an increase in cases. There were 1,226 cases of polio worldwide in 2020, compared with 138 in 2018. Now is the time to double down and really make sure that we stop transmission, that we're able to deliver a polio-free world, to John Vertifuelli, Chief of the Polio Eradication Branch at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one of the partners in the global initiative. Progress is being made. Last August, African countries were declared free of wild polio virus, which means that Afghanistan and Pakistan are the only two countries where polio remains endemic. Late last year, the World Health Organization gave emergency authorization to a new vaccine that could minimize polio outbreaks. Okay, well, this week I have half a dozen bonus articles that you can read online, and I'll give you the link at the end. Up first, one, epidemiology, not geopolitics, should guide COVID-19 vaccine donations. Two, the COVID lab leak hypothesis, what scientists do and don't know. I'll just comment on that, saying that we can do more than one thing at once. We can chew gum and walk. We can deal with lab security and the emergence of zoonoses, that is transmission from animals to humans. Number three, a tool doctors use every day can perpetuate medical racism. It's called the history of present illness, and it often includes a patient's race, which is more likely to detract from care than improve it. Four, one from the public health history files, trailblazing transgender doctor saves countless lives. After transitioning in 1917, Alan Hart helped alter medical history. Five, spreading vaccine fears and cashing in. Meet the influencers making millions by dealing doubt about the coronavirus vaccines. And six, the fundamental question of the pandemic is shifting. We understand how this will end, but who bears the risk that remains? A good article covering some fundamental public health tenets. You can read these at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-